succession number 28457, reel 9.
Nigel Matthews, reel 9. After you'd completed your time in the Triumph, what happened next?
After Triumph, I think I'd forgotten.
I think you returned to do some training courses or courses?
Yes, I did a staff course and a tactical course, and then I went to run the junior officer's air course at Leon Seland for sub-lieutenants. These courses lasted for 3 weeks, and they came through in a pipeline. And I did that for 18 months.
What did they have to do in those
days? Well, it was familiarisation with the Fleet Air Arm, because the Fleet Air Arm was still, to a degree, a race apart. And these sub-lieutenants had never sort of been in an aeroplane. So we gave them air experience from the small flight of aeroplanes we had. We flew it down the channel, and we gave them turbine jet. And we learned about the great battles of the World War II, like the Philippines and Taranto and things like that. All to do with to try and convince them that there was a future in air power, and that air power was vital for the Navy. That was the object of JOAC, really.
I wouldn't have thought after the Second World War there was any question about that.
Well, you'd be surprised. The thing was that young officers didn't get any air stuff. They were in there to learn about ships, and they didn't learn about carriers, apart from the fact there were carriers. And one or two of them said, well, I want to fly, and they went to flew. But fundamentally, the Navy now, I think, is probably sort of rather different. It's evolved. But even then, there were certain traditional aspects of naval upbringing. And the young officers, which I met as sub-lieutenants then, were very like us in the sub-lieutenants that when I was a sub-lieutenant in the war. And we like to think that after 3 weeks, which is all they had with us, they had an understanding. But it's all a bit mystifying, and you don't really come to terms or really understand in depth the need for air power. And the fact is, you really can't operate at all without air power here and there, or unless you've got air superiority, or unless the opposition has no air power. But the attitude of the sub-lieutenants are very similar. And it was very interesting because you met all these young men coming through, and they came through in courses of about 16 to 20. And one had the pleasure of playing with them and working with them and socialising with them, and it was very good. And I think an exposure to the Fleet Air Arm, where the attitudes, for example, in Fleet Air Arm mess are different. The great occasions of Taranto Night, for example, is celebrated with at least as much enthusiasm as Trafalgar Night elsewhere. It's not like Trafalgar Night at the College of Greenwich, but on the other hand, it's a very important thing. And Leon Seland was the headquarters of the Naval Aviation then, and so Taranto Night was a great thing. And they were imbued with these spirits.
Could you describe what happened?
At Taranto Night?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to say it was Taranto Night dinner. So we had a formal dinner, and there was a toast at the end to the Fleet Air Arm, and one for the Battle of Taranto. And but you had a formal guest night, and it was quite a big occasion. But in the 3 weeks that the sub-lieutenants were there, to show them that actually the Fleet Arm were not all heretics, we nearly always tried to have a guest night, so that they would see that we were still doing things in the good old naval way, which was quite important, we felt. Anyway, after 18 months of doing that, which was extremely enjoyable, I had the family living over 100 yards from the main gate in Leon Seland and that sort of thing, I got a plum appointment with NA2SL, which was the Naval Assistant to the Second Sea Lord. That's to say, the appointments branch of the Navy, and I did the appointments for the observers the pilots and observers in the Fleet Air Arm in Queen Anne's Mansions.
And what did that involve?
Oh, that involved appointing the pilots in the Fleet Air Arm to their various slots and arranging their careers and, you know, sending them out to squadrons or training or whatever it was they had to do.
I mean, did you interview them? in terms of their aptitude. No, I mean, I remember you saying that you suddenly found yourself plonked into the...
That was the war. Here, quite a lot of attention was given to trying to put the right chap into the, you know, the square peg into the square hole, as opposed to the opposite. But you did have access to all the confidential reports of the officers, including, which is no longer the case, your own. And that was quite revealing. Anyway, I did that for 2 years, nearly, after, at the end of which I got promoted to commander. And then I got rheumatic fever and went to some, which took 3 months out of my life, from which I seemed to have made a remarkable recovery. I didn't get it till I was 4, I think. And it's probably not down there. And you quite often have heart problems. And I did have a heart problem much later in life. But I didn't from that, and I was able to get my flying category back. So I was able to fly again. But after that, I did some refresher training. And one of the perks of being in the appointments branch was that you could virtually pick your own appointment. And I was quite keen to go to the States, but I asked one of the directors in the Admiralty whether he thought that was a good idea. And he said, well, quite frankly, Nigel, I don't think you're experienced enough. But I'd started flying very late, and there were some very, very qualified people. I mean, I didn't have a tremendous number of hours. I didn't have much experience on a vast number of airplanes. And so he said he thought that while I could try, I might well be turned down. So rather than do that, I thought I'd do something entirely different. And because I could speak French, I said, well, I wouldn't mind having a NATO job. Well, from the career point of view, of course, that was not very clever, because you go to NATO jobs and nobody believes any of the reports, which are highly sort of eulogistic, and always, because they're written by a foreigner, and they never give offence, you know, to a stranger. We had two years and a half in Malta with there, and I travelled the Med doing all sorts of things with NATO. I
mean, so you weren't actually flying?
No, not flying. Yeah. I did fly to keep my hand in, because I was still a qualified pilot, and they had a meteor at Halfar. I used to go up there and try and fly about once a fortnight. But if you don't fly regularly, you get out of practice. And one day I scared myself absolutely witless, and so I decided to stop flying, which I did. I didn't fly much after about 1956, I think. Yes, about that, middle 30s.
What did your NATO job involve?
Well, NATO was flying. It was a thing called Naval Control of Shipping. In those days, we still talked in terms of a nuclear war starting and the replenishment of Europe being one of the vital aspects of post-nuclear exchange, which involved the control of convoys. And there was a tremendous organisation involving naval control of shipping officers at all the ports all over the world, particularly around the Med, which was my part of ship. And these were sort of existed in order to have the framework of an organisation, which, if the occasion ever arose, you would be able to put into effect a convoy system to keep Europe going when it had been decimated by nuclear bombs. Sounds crazy now.
Well, where were the convoys going to be coming from?
Oh, America.
Which, of course, wasn't going to be decimated.
Well, that's right, yes. And the Empire. Because it had an empire then, you know. But anyway, that was the theory. And to do this, I travelled. I went to Paris, I went to Nice, I went to Turkey, I went to Greece. And we spent about 3 or 4 days in each place. And it was lovely, great life. Mark you, it didn't do much good in the naval context, because, as I say, nobody really counted on the reports that you got. Anyway, my wife was beginning to suffer a bit from ill health, and so I wasn't too desperately concerned. and my priorities were that. And so then, after that, I got a command, and they gave me a ship, a frigate called Lock Inch. That I don't even know where Lock Inch is, but it's in Scotland in the Highlands. And I went out to the Persian Gulf for a year, which is no place to go if you've got family men, but there you are.
I'm just, what made you get a command? Did you apply for it?
Oh, I see. Oh, no, one of the things that happened along the way, actually when I was in NA2SL, was that the list of naval officers was split, and you were either wet or dry. If you were dry, you were told you were never going to get a command at sea. If you were wet, you still had a chance. I was wet because I'd been to Dartmouth, and I had a bit of a record. And anyway, that's why I got a ship, and they pointed me to a ship. I, in fact, felt that I was better suited, because I knew how inexperienced I was about running a ship, particularly with 2 years in NATO, which is absolute swan, that really you should, I would do better and thrive more if I had a bit of competition. I'd rather have been one of four in a flotilla rather than one on its own. But I had a great time. I mean, there is nothing like driving your own ship around the place. And we went out to the, we did work up at Portland. Ship was based in Devonport. And we were away for a year and went to through the Med, same old trek, Red Sea, Aden, Persian Gulf, refit in Karachi. Oh, Khyber Pass. I'm one of the few naval officers ever been at the Khyber Pass. When we got, we were halfway through the commission, one went to refit in Karachi. And I turned my attention to thinking what I was going to do for a month's refit in Karachi with a couple of hundred odd sailors. And so I thought that the shore staff there were very good at sort of receiving ship. But I thought it would be a good idea to do something quite different. So I said, does anybody want to go to the Khyber Pass? I'll see if I see people who want to go to the Khyber Pass. So I rang up the Pakistani group captain at the airbase at Karachi and said, what about this? And he said, good gosh, yes, any time. Let's give you a Bristol freighter. So he gave us a Bristol freighter, and which would take 50 people. And we went to Peshawar. We flew to Peshawar, where the resident looked after us. And we went on a wonderful trip up the Khyber. And it was amazing, really. Not things that found many sailors doing. I suppose the highlight of the trip, apart from the fact that you were actually there, and we got as far as the border looking down onto Kabul and Afghanistan, there were two things, really. One was visiting a factory where they made, handmade, copies of the Enfield rifles, using a sort of old foot lathe thing to drill the barrel. Amazing. And the other thing was having lunch with the Khyber Rifles at their mess in Landal Koti, which is halfway up the Khyber, where they had a fort. And they had a walled garden in the middle, the most lovely green lawn, roses everywhere, and it was more British than the Brits could do it. We had a wonderful day. And anyway, we got back to Peshawar and flew back and back up the Gulf again until it was time to get home.
What was it like having command of a
marvellous
vessel?
Fantastic. First of all, you are your own boss very largely, and if you're independent, your problems are only ones of morale, how to keep the sailors entertained. By the time I got a ship for the Persian Gulf, which used to be a place where naughty boys were sent, we were air-conditioned. But the ships, of course, before were not, and it was really sort of sticky stuff. But you know, you were on your own. You visited these places. You called on the sheikhs. You had a mutton grab, you know, cross legs, having mutton feasts in the desert and that sort of thing. And you could fish. You could do various activities. We had a small Royal Marines contingent, and they did things. We had one scare about possibly going to war with Iraq. We didn't. We went up the river to Basra instead. And but the thing about driving a ship is that there is a moment when you first take your ship to sea, which is, I suppose, really, one of the highlights of my life. I mean, you talk about getting solo in an aircraft, but when you cast, when for the first time, quite late in the day, they give you a ship and you ask permission, which is a custom, if you can sail, really to sort of permission to proceed is a great cry, and you get the signal back approved, and you cast off everything and you say, "Slow speed ahead," and the ship moves. Fantastic.
But you, I mean, obviously as the commander, you're pretty lonely.
Oh, yeah. Well, commander's always lonely.
And how do you run a ship?
Well, you have a well-tried organisation, a first lieutenant, who's your executive officer. You have a torpedo officer, you have a navigator. And that's another lucky thing, you have a properly qualified navigating officer, and you have 150-odd under sailors. And they all know what to do, and all you have to do is keep them happy.
And how do you keep them happy?
Well, you have to... Well, there are certain things you have to do which are operational. I mean, you work up at Portland for a month, and that's quite demanding because they put you to all sorts of tests and things, attack submarines and dummy attacks and that sort of thing, and you tow ship and you learn how to handle the ship a bit coming on, so, and so forth. But when you're on a long trek, there are ways of keeping people entertained, and nowadays it's music, it's games on board, but there's watchkeeping goes on all the time, and if there's anything to see, well, you go and see it. And sailors are quite interested, but at the end of a 6 to 9 months, they've probably had enough. You know, home is beginning to call fairly loudly.
How do you deal with the discipline on board? I mean, to set the right tone, to keep...
Well, you have other ships, yes. You have other ships which come along and you compete with them at various things like pulling races, rowing races, and games. You have a social life, and there's people very good at looking after sailors. If you go to up to Basra, for example, the British resident will probably have a party for, you know, 30, 40 sailors, and they'd all go off and have a good time. You have things called banyans when you're in a place like the Gulf, when you're away from anything, when you have a day in which discipline is set aside for a day, and they have all sorts of crazy games and dress up and do very childish things to keep sort of people interested. But intrinsically, so long as the ship is working all right and you're efficient in the ship and you have competitions with other ships and you have an inspection to which you all look forward to, or not, as the case may be, and that's how morale is kept up. But as I say, after a time it gets more difficult. People have demands made upon them which they're as well qualified to meet.
Examples of times when your skills were tested?
If you are not a fish, which I was not, then if you meet up with a ship that is commanded by a chap who knows all about driving ships, and he challenges you to things, you have difficulty competing. And I had some difficulty. and I lost more times than I won, but it was all right, and everybody enjoyed it, and our morale was the higher for having got slightly better and nearer. And the nearer you get to providing a match, the better you will be off to sort of keeping the morale up. But if there's anything different, you can give them something. The Khyber Pass was so good because it was different. Nobody had ever done that before. We went to Cochin for Christmas, and Cochin's a nice place.
What was the most difficult thing about commanding a ship?
Well, I personally, and it's a personal thing with me, find the most difficult thing was being totally independent. You mentioned the loneliness of command before, and if you're independent command, well, I would have been better suited to being in competition with three or four other people and able to socialise with them. There is an artificiality between life ashore in the Gulf and life aboard, and you have to entertain yourself. And I entertained myself mostly reading, a bit of fishing, doing things when I could. Very good crowd of officers I had.
Do you go into the wardroom from time
to time? Oh, yes. You are made an honorary member of the wardroom mess, and you're free to go when you want to. But you don't want to do it too often.
You have to maintain a certain distance?
Well, there has to be a distance, yes. Some people can get away with it. I don't think I would want to try that too much. Too risky.
And, forgive me, it sounds a basic question. What did your job as a commander involve?
Oh, well, I mean, I've said it all. It's really maintaining the efficiency and discipline in your ship. And it all builds up to the inspection when every department is tested.
And who does the inspection?
Oh, the senior officer, whoever it is, normally an admiral, but in the Gulf it was a commodore, who was a captain in the job, and he just commodore's rank.
And how often would that take place?
Once in the commission. Towards the end, just before you go there. But ship handling's fun. And one thing about a lock class frigate is that you have lovely old push me pull you engines, you know, reciprocating engines, not the ones that turbines. And so you get a very quick response. And you can, especially if you're an aviator when your reactions are not too good, you can. And make life quite exciting for other people who know what you're doing, which I was got better at.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about that time?
No, I don't think so. Not about the command. I mean, I've exhausted that.
When your commission was finished, what happened then?
When I was finished in the commission, I got a job at Latimer, which was a Joint Services Staff College. I had got, as one grows up and goes on, one gets to having people that one knows, more contemporaries, in the levels of influence. And I got this job at Latimer. The Joint Services Staff College was an outfit put together because there was alleged to be insufficient jointry after the war. And so they had this place in the depths of the countryside, Buckinghamshire, a place called Latimer. Ever heard of it? And very nice for the directing staff. You get a married quarter, lovely surroundings, and you have a lot of very interesting people, Army, Navy, RAF, the odd American, you get an American from each one of the three services, and Foreign Office chap. And
the idea is to foster cooperation between the services.
Yes, that's right, but also understanding of one another. It's not just cooperation, it's understanding. Because the problems of the three services are very different. And they have, and that's why they are so different. And it's an interesting fact that the Navy have always been attuned to the Army. but the RAF less attuned to either, in my opinion. But the armies in the old days, you see, always had to get look to the Navy to take them. I mean, you take a classic example of Gallipoli, when they were dependent on the Navy to get them there and look after them, even though it was a total disaster. Nowadays, I'm not so certain, because the operations that the Army are constantly doing with the RAF probably leads to a better understanding there, whereas the Navy doesn't have many tank landing craft. They had a few in the Falklands, it's true, but they were the Royal Fleet Auxiliaries. They were not sort of the Royal Navy. But the Joint Services Staff College, actually you're moving up a grade, beginning to learn about politics and Whitehall and things like that, which I personally found extraordinarily interesting, but they're not everybody's cup of tea.
How long were you there for?
2 years.
In the 1960s?
Yes, early 60s.
Early 60s.
And then I went back to NATO in shape. I realised then that it was very unlikely that I would get promoted to captain. So I decided that I would cut my losses on that and go to somewhere I knew I could enjoy myself. So I went to NATO in shape, which was just outside Paris, and we spent 2.5 years there before it went to Belgium.
And what were you doing there?
I was the head of naval intelligence, would you believe? The shape, you know, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, is an essentially land-air beast. It's the army and it's the air force, but it acknowledges the fact that there is a navy. There was a slot there for a British naval officer, in among some French, Italians, and a Dutchman, and some Americans, in intelligence, and I opted for that. As you may remember, I said my wife wasn't terribly well by then, and I wanted a job where we could, I could be close at hand if necessary. And we lived in a manner to which I'm not normally accustomed, very grand indeed, 25 miles from base, and I commuted every day. But we lived out in a place called just near Mantes, about 40 miles west of Paris. And it was absolutely lovely, and I could speak the language right up my street.
What sort of things were you doing as a naval intelligence?
Oh, well, you had... you were in a position of some authority, because they didn't understand about the navies and ships at all. Apart from the fact that there was alleged to be an amphibious threat in the Bosphorus from the Russians coming down the Black Sea, and, of course, there was a submarine threat. That was dealt with by the naval people, like the ones in Malta. At shape, you had access to your own admiral, who was a very small British naval staff, but he was known as the vice naval deputy, typical sort of NATO thing. But what I found fascinating about the job was that you learned so much about other people. I mean, Germans, Italians, Frenchmen, Greeks, Turks, and you had dinner with them, you took them out to dinner, they took you out to dinner, you had Paris alongside, you had some very jolly times, but there was this extraordinary political undercurrent of the clash between NATO and the Allied headquarters and national demands. And I think the Brits were probably the only ones who... the Americans never asked anybody anything, because they were so directed from... they just did what they were told. But everybody else would ring up. You know, if they were asked to do something, they would say, I must just sort of bring up Istanbul or something first, and they would ring up Istanbul and see if it was all right. Now, the only people who would be proper allies, in my opinion, were the Brits, because the Brits wouldn't bring up the Minister of Defence every time the bell struck. They would simply, if they thought it was a good idea, they'd say, yeah, sure, fine. And then they'd tell the Minister of Defence what they'd done, and nobody ever objected, very, very seldom. But that was because, after the war, the British, the respect in which the British were held was enormous in Europe.
Nigel Matthews.